who's the Pope, you know, and who's the church, and why are they imposing? Well, and Pope Leo says it, look, we're not imposing a thing. The church does recognize that we have an opportunity to help influence in the right way with this evangelical charity. Again, so it's not the here's what you need to do, but it's look at us as an example. And here's how we can do life better with you, even if you're not Catholic. And we'll get to that in later chapters. But he's saying, even if you're not, you know, from other denominations, right? Or even from other world religions, look, we're walking through this together.
3, 2, 1. Welcome to Love Machine. Welcome to another episode of Nerding Out with That Nerdy Catholic. I'm Seth Payne. I'm here with my co-nerd, Lee. And I want to let you know that Cesar is still on a break from recording with us. He is still looking for a job, and there are a few other complicated things that are going on in his life. So we'd appreciate it if you could keep him in your prayers. But today we are continuing our deep dive into Magnifica Humanitas. We are starting Chapter 1, and we're going to get a few paragraphs in, but I think we're going to spend at least a couple, if not more than that, episodes on Chapter 1. But this whole encyclical is just drenched with so much wisdom and so many things that Lee and I are just really excited to jump into. But before we get started, I want to remind you that if you go over to thatnerdycatholic.com, you can sign up for our email list and get updates when we put out new episodes. If you go to thatnerdycatholic.com/merch, you can get Nerdy Catholic swag, t-shirts, mugs, and prints to show the world that you can be a nerd and a Catholic at the same time. And you can go to thatnerdycatholic.com/support to help support us financially. Our expenses here at That Nerdy Catholic have gone up recently, and any financial support you can give us would be greatly appreciated. You can send a one-off tip or join as a monthly supporter. So, good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Seth. How are you?
Good.
Well, this is exciting. This part of Rerum Novarum, we're getting into the thick of things here. And I didn't realize while I was rereading this that there's a lot in this document.
Oh, I know. I know. And I think we're definitely going to be looking at this and pulling out everything that we can think of as far as AI. But what I think is really interesting about the first chapter is that it doesn't really talk a lot about AI at all. It talks about a lot of the issues of Catholic social teaching. And then later on, it will look at how that applies to AI.
Right. Yep. And that's a really good reminder that this encyclical, and I love how Pope Leo frames this, is you can't look at AI without looking at its social impacts. And you can't talk about its social impacts until you talk about how the church is structured and its position on informing people about social impacts. So that's what's really cool about this. You know, he's really taking the time to explain to us what is the church's social doctrine and how can we look at it more authentically. So it'll be fun to look at and go through.
Yeah. And by the time we record one of the later episodes, I should have this, but I was just talking to my wife the other day and saying that I want to get at least two copies of the Ducat for our daughters. Have you heard of that?
No.
So do you know the UCAT?
Oh, yep. Yep.
UCAT's so the great. UCAT, it's a catechism for youth. The Ducat is the same thing, except it's all on the social doctrine, the social teachings of the church.
Ooh, I'm going to have to look that one up.
And so I've been wanting to read it for a while, and we've been talking about some issues with our daughters around, you know, some of the social teachings of the church. So I'm like, oh, I gotta get that just, you know, to go through it with them for their sake, but also for mine. Cause I realized recently that there's so much that I still need to learn about the social Catholic doctrine of the church.
Yeah, well, and certainly Pope Leo talks about, and there are references to it as well. I need to look up that Ducat. That sounds really interesting. But he does reference the compendium of the social doctrine of the church, which is online and really, really good the way that it's broken out, because it's got a lot of, you know, this huge clickable table of contents, and its intro is fantastic as well. So if anyone is looking for more information on kind of the church's position on social doctrine and wants something that's free, the Vatican's, you know, does a really nice job on the compendium of the social doctrine of the church that Leo references.
Cool. What we're looking at today is kind of the introduction to that. And in the next episode, we're going to jump really deep into the history, going from all the way from Rerum Novarum up to today, on just a really quick overview of everything that's been taught and written about in the last 150 years on the topic. So now as we jump in, I want to start off just as an explanation. If you've never read an encyclical before, this was confusing to me the first time I read an encyclical, that you have the document in sections. In this encyclical, you have the introduction, chapter one, chapter two, but then you also have paragraph numbers. And this is how the church writes things. It numbers the paragraphs. And the thing that is always confusing to me is the paragraph is not a paragraph, because some of these paragraphs have three or four paragraphs in them. But whenever you're referring to a document, usually you say, okay, in paragraph 15. Right. And so as you're going through this document, you see these numbered sections, and it's just how church documents are written. So I'm assuming that's just to make it easy to reference exactly where you are. It's the same thing with the catechism. So if you ever hear someone say, well, if you look in the catechism, paragraph 2,214, there's a lot of paragraphs in there. Yep. So we're going to start off with paragraph 17. In this first chapter, I intend to present synthetically how the social doctrine of the church has taken shape in the recent papal magisterium and in the Second Vatican Council in order to demonstrate its dynamic character. Indeed, in each era, the res novae require that this teaching address historical questions in the light of revealed truth. In this regard, artificial intelligence, too, should not be considered as merely yet another theme to be studied or a crisis to be managed, but rather as a development that challenges the categories of social doctrine from within, calling for their further development in fidelity to the gospel.
So I put some notes in our document when we were researching this, that I love this, and you and I were talking about it right before we hit record, that this astounds me, this sentence here. In this regard, artificial intelligence too should not be considered as merely yet another theme to be studied or a crisis to be managed, but it challenges the categories of social doctrine from within.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking of all of these befores and afters, and just coming from the IT world, you know, we always think like, well, there was before the internet and after the internet, you know, there was before the iPhone and after the iPhone. And, you know, the church was silent on those things for the most part. And I think that's going to be a fun discussion to talk about maybe why for that as well. But for a pope to say that what's happening with AI required a response from the church, to me is pretty astounding, because I think there's a lot of people out there still that are like, maybe this is just a fad, maybe it's a bubble, you know, maybe things are going to go away. And here we have an admittance of, no, this isn't just another crisis to be managed or a theme to be studied. There is a before AI and an after AI. And Pope Leo is admitting that.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that's really confusing, I've been learning a little bit into, you know, the last few decades with all these bubbles. And realizing that the internet bubble, like the dot-com bubble, had nothing to do with the internet coming and going away. I mean, the bubble is all just is all a financial thing.
Yeah.
You know, the issue of, you know, too much money being thrown into it and then the money disappearing because these companies, individual companies, didn't pan out, you know. But the internet, you know, the internet hasn't gone away. You know, the cell phone hasn't gone away. And so, I think that, you know, Pope John Paul II and maybe even Pope Benedict and Pope Francis, I wonder, were they not as attuned to the technology to say, is this really society changing. And maybe Pope Leo, maybe because he's an American, I don't know, but maybe he is just more attuned to what is going on in the world of technology.
Yeah. Were these other popes, I mean, Pope Francis maybe to a lesser extent, because he did address a lot of issues, maybe not head on like Pope Leo is, but there were things that he would say on the side, like, oh, and by the way, the internet's going to destroy the world, you know, and he'd say that on the side.
And, well, like, and actually, he did, and we have read in the past, some excerpts from this, he did address the G7 like a year or so before he passed away on artificial intelligence.
That's right. Yeah, he did. So he almost had a finger on the pulse. I wonder if people like, well, of course, so Pope Leo, I think maybe some good framework for this, and this is something that a lot of Catholics were talking about before he was elected Pope, was this is the first Pope that was not around during World War II. In recent memory. So you almost have this, you know, it was Pope John Paul II. Was he too close to the world of before the internet to sort of be very skeptical, you know, of whether or not this was really a life-changing thing and whether or not it was necessary, you know? And I think you kind of have that skepticism of some people that have maybe grown up in the eras without the internet, and they just don't see it, you know, and they can live life fine without it and everything else. But then you have these generations that grew up with the internet, and they're like, no, my life would absolutely be destroyed if there were no internet. Or if there were no phone, I would absolutely be destroyed. So now you have a pope that's come in, and he is a product of kind of these technological advances. And he's saying, no, this is absolutely a life-changing thing.
Well, I mean, technically, you can say we grew up in that era before all this technology, but we were young.
Yep.
My daughters are just so shocked when I tell them that I didn't get my first cell phone until I was in my 20s. What are you talking about? Why'd you wait so long? I'm like, I didn't wait so long. When I was 18, cell phones were still the size of a brick and cost $1,000.
My favorite with young adults that I talk to, I run a young adult ministry. My favorite thing is always, I was literally married before the iPhone came out. And they're like, no, there's no way.
Yes.
It's like, well, it wasn't 50 years ago. You know, we think that this has been around for such a long time, and it really hasn't been. And we talked about this a couple of podcasts ago, I think, that the speed at which technology has advanced in the last couple of decades has just been astronomical and different. There was a slow roll to technological advances from World War II, you know, all the way through the 80s. And we saw it with, you know, the birth of, you know, the atomic energy phase and all of these things. And so I think for Pope John Paul II, he's looking at this as like, okay, this is a slow, gradual roll, you know, and we mentioned, when are we going to start pumping the brakes on AI? Because this thing is, boy, it was just a few months ago, recent memory, Seth, where you and I can say like, hey, I wasn't even a thing.
Right. Well, I saw a video recently. It was a 1 or 2 minute video, but it was looking at in the past, I think it was about 3 years ago, when we saw that first video, AI generated video of Will Smith eating spaghetti. Oh. It looked so awful.
Oh my goodness. I forgot about that.
And this was, it had then 4 or 5 short clips of Will Smith eating spaghetti created every 6 to 9 months over the past 3 years. And the difference between the first one and the one that was just made, I think it was about, you know, 3 months ago, is night and day. You could understand if someone looked at the latest one and said, oh, that's just a video of Will Smith eating spaghetti. And the first one, his face is morphing and there's
contorted.
There's spaghetti coming out of his cheek and it's...
Right. No, you're
absolutely. We're really on in the past 50 years with technology. It really, you know, people talk about the hockey stick as far as, you know, the exponential growth. We're still on that rate, not only the rate of growth, but the rate of growth keeps increasing.
I think about that for a second too. I mean, the Will Smith thing's hilarious. If someone looks it up, I think it was 2023 that came out. From 2023, we're here in 2026. We've got this new encyclical from a pope saying that AI needs to be addressed as a social disruption. And it's only been 3 years. I mean, that's absolutely crazy. to think about and to kind of, I guess, noodle on. That was a terrible dad pun, but it's, you know, it's that, that idea of like what the swiftness of the acceleration of technology. And yes. And really, it's put us in this place with AI specifically as this tool that's like, we can no longer just look at this as some sort of fad or, wow, that's interesting. Maybe this is something we need to study further. And it's like, No, we're coming right down to it. This can destroy society. And if we're not doing things right, we're either, you know, like we said last time, building that Tower of Babel, or we're building the wall together as humanity.
Yep. Well, and then I really appreciate that this first chapter is all about the social doctrine of the church.
Yeah.
Because like we talked about in one of the previous episodes, this could be a Ready Player One situation where you have the masses are placated by the coolness of AI and yet have no control. And the social doctrine of the church focusing so much on really the gospel, how many times Jesus talks about caring for the poor. You know, I was actually thinking the other day, one of my coworkers has one of the Bible software packages that you can, you know, search and do all this research in scripture. But how many times does the scripture talk about caring for the poor and the foreigner among us versus any other moral issue? It's all through scripture, taking care of the poor and the foreigner among you. And so we need to be so careful that this technology does not become just another tool like what happened in the Industrial Revolution.
Right. Well, and we need to remember too, that that's such a great point, Seth. You know, well, Jesus can tell us, what's the greatest commandment? Well, love God with all your heart. Oh, and there's also a second greatest commandment.
It's the same. And he said, it's the same.
It's the same. Love your neighbor as yourself. And it's so easy to separate those two, I think, in our minds, even as Christians and Catholics. But really, like you said it, I love that you pointed that out. That's one of the most talked about things in the gospel. That's literally the good news, right? Is that this is open to all of us, but it isn't just, well, and Pope Leo talks about this. Maybe we'll get to it in a couple of paragraphs, this idea of unity. You know, it's this whole, you know, the unified, you know, the world and how we're addressing artificial intelligence. And maybe we'll keep reading before we get along to that too far.
Yeah. So let's jump into paragraph 18. Why don't you read that, Lee?
Sure. This overview, however, would not be very comprehensible if, before reflecting on the contribution of individual popes and their most relevant documents, we do not first clarify some fundamental principles concerning the way in which the church exists in history and relates to the world. Failing to do so would expose social doctrine to the risk of being perceived as an undue interference in worldly matters or as an external code of ethics imposed from above. In reality, it stems from a church that walks alongside humanity, recognizes the autonomy of earthly realities and the distinction between ecclesial and political communities. Indeed, it is for this very reason that she strives to serve the common good.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I think we really need to look at what this means when it says the risk of being perceived as an undue interference in worldly matters or as an extreme code of ethics imposed from above. I think some people could read that and say, well, I guess what he's saying here is the church doesn't have anything to say to the world because it's worldly. Mm. And, you know, it's so easy to say, well, the church is here to teach morality, and so therefore, of course, it should impose it. But I like this idea that the church is here. Yes, the church is a moral authority in the world. But it's so easy to create a distinction between here's the moral teachings, here are all the moral teachings, and here's just the way the world works. The way I read this, there's no distinction between morality and the way the world works.
I'm doing a young adult study with, we're going through the book of Ephesians, and this reminds me a lot of Ephesians, and I noted this in a couple of different paragraphs too, where he's talking about unity. But it's this idea that the Catholic Church, you know, she is looking at the world as, we're part of the kingdom of God. we're in it, you know, and it, this is our opportunity as a church to be able to say, this is how we can use the gospel, always our eyes on the gospel, like we talked about in the last paragraph, to show people how we can live more fully and completely as Christians, as Catholics, you know, taking care of our neighbor, everything that we just talked about. And that's a big difference than, well, this world is not our own, I'm just passing through, right? And we need to kind of shed this mortal coil and all get up to heaven because everything's a mess and it doesn't matter anyway. And that's right. Such a different
why work on this world? That's something that a lot of non-Christians will say about Christianity in general. It's like, well, you're just so worried about getting to heaven that you're not doing anything to make life on this world better. And there is some validity in that argument towards some groups. You know, I think there are some groups of Christians, I would say maybe some, you know, evangelical groups that are so focused on getting people to heaven that there isn't a focus on any social doctrine.
Well, that's right. And we talked a lot about this.
I mean, that was my experience growing up.
No, yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's where I think Ephesians, you know, especially in light of Paul's letters, not to deviate too much from Rerum Novarum, but just really quickly, you've got, you know, Galatians and Romans that talk about, you know, justification and faith and things like that. You've got Ephesians kind of smack dab in the middle of this that's his addressing is really like, we're not Gnostics.
Yes.
I mean, this is the point. Like, this isn't some, you know, spiritual warfare of we just need to get out of here. I mean, the inheritance that we have is that, you know, what Christ did on the cross was sufficient. And here we are in the kingdom of God here and now. And this is our opportunity to spread the gospel to the world. And what Pope Leo is saying is we can spread the gospel to the world through social doctrine. You cannot separate the two, and it's a beautiful thing to look at. So, a quick side note on there. Read through the six chapters of Ephesians and realize that social doctrine is so important to the unity of the church and being able to spread the gospel to the world, and we aren't Gnostics.
Yes, and we'll come back to this more in other paragraphs, but this image that Pope Leo works into a lot of these paragraphs that the church walks alongside humanity. Mm. Because in a way, the church is holy. The church is God's. Jesus founded the church. But the church is also human. And so it's not a foreign entity that is imposed on top of humanity. It is humanity. I mean, it's humanity because we are humans and we're all in the church.
Yeah.
And also because Christ was human. And Christ found that. So there's the nature of the church is like Christ, that it is both divine and human. And so being human, it is in the world and it is in society.
Well, and that, speaking of your kind of our evangelical experience and our background and things, it's the church is God coming down to humanity, not us trying to go up. Yes. You know, to God and free ourselves from these things. You know, the church is saying, no, we can bring God down. You know, we're creating this society and this indwelling so that we can have a slice of heaven right now. You know, we can have the presence of God here and now. And it's not something that we're having to necessarily wait for and just persevere through. And that's really, to me, one of the biggest differences in, you know, growing up with my background versus being a Catholic, is this idea of the incarnate God, you know, coming down and dwelling within us, within the church, versus, boy, I can't wait to just get out of here.
Yeah.
Right. That's what makes it important. That's what makes looking at documents like this important for the Christian is, wow, this is our responsibility.
Yes.
This isn't just something we can sit back and just watch the world burn. No, this is our responsibility.
Yeah, we need to always be working to make, as Pope Francis said a lot of times, our common home.
Right.
We have to take care of it. And it is true that our ultimate end is in heaven with God, but that is not some far off sitting in the clouds playing a harp image a lot of people have.
Right.
The image that I like to look at is the parable of the talents.
Mm-hmm.
That you had this landowner and he gave one servant, you know, one talent, one servant, five talent, two talents and one servant, five talents. And then the one with five and 10 went out and invested it and worked and came back and doubled it. But the thing that I like to focus on in that parable is at the end, the landowner said, "You were responsible for little things. I will put you in charge of greater things."
Yeah.
And that is our call. That is the call that God has for us, is this continual growing into this person that we were created to be at the beginning of working with God, and greater responsibility, not as a load to bear, but as a son or a daughter taking ownership with their father of all the stuff that he has created for us to do. And so that's both here and in heaven. We're going to continually be growing in that understanding of our relationship with God.
Right.
But it has to start right now.
Right. And I think that's such a good segue to paragraph 21, if we're just kind of skipping down there.
Sure. That,
you know, there's this idea, you know, a lot of people might be listening and being like, well, what gives the church the authority to impose anything? Why would the church even care? Why would they impose things on society? And how are we supposed to respond to that? Because it does seem like this top-down thing. Look, it's this big, rich institution and this government, you know, in and of itself at the Vatican. And what gives the church the right? You know, and I think paragraph 21 addresses this so well and so clearly. But it's kind of a neat starting point of like, okay, if you have that thought, hopefully it's kind of saying, I'm sure some of you are thinking this. And I'm going to tell you right now what the point of the church is and what it claims to do and what it doesn't do.
All right. So why don't you read 21?
Sure. So the church does not claim to assume the functions belonging to the state. On the contrary, she esteems those who serve the common good, and she firmly acknowledges the responsibility that civil institutions hold within society. At the same time, the mission entrusted to the church prompts her to address the real suffering of the men and women of our time. This closeness does not stem from an intent to supplant civil institutions, much less from an implicit criticism of their work. Rather, it stems from evangelical charity, which impels the church to draw near to the wounds of humanity whenever they surface with greater severity. When the church intervenes, she does so following the example of the Good Samaritan with discretion and closeness, aware that what arises from urgent necessity cannot become the norm, nor replace the institutional responsibilities proper to the civil community.
Yeah. Wow.
That image, you know, of and Pope Leo says it right there, that image. Well, the church is telling us what to do. No, actually, we're the Good Samaritan. So everyone else that's walking by suffering man, you know, the suffering men and women of our time, they're walking by in the church. We're the ones that are stopping and saying, wait a second, you forgot something.
Yes. Well, and this is a good place to acknowledge that we know that there are people, and I wouldn't even say there are people. I know that in my own life, it has been easy to fall into this role of imposing, role of saying, well, this is right and this is wrong. And I'm doing all I can to do what's right. And there are all these people around me that's doing what's wrong. Therefore, it's my job to let them know what's right and what's wrong. And the last maybe like six months or a year, this thought keeps coming back to me about, now this is a little bit of an aside, but thinking about the role of pointing out what's right and what's wrong, I feel that there are a lot of, and I'm sure I'm going to get some slack for this. I think there are some people out there that are so focused on telling the world what is right and what's wrong that I've been thinking, well, where is the place for that? Well, the place for such focus on morality has to be in the church. Because what is the point of doing what's right and not doing what's wrong if you do not know who God is? If you are not in a relationship with God, if you do not understand who he is and are on that journey with him and towards him, then what's the point of doing, and this is my kind of a hyperbole, but what's the point of doing the good thing if you don't know God? And our job, like you said, we're the Good Samaritan. We are there to do the right thing, to help people so that we can draw them to God, and then they can start growing and doing what's right and not doing what's wrong.
Right. Well, in the depth too of some of these references that you know, and maybe some of the assumptions that Pope Leo is making in some of these biblical stories. Of course, we talked about Nehemiah last time. You know, I think a lot of people maybe weren't even familiar with that story and building the wall of Jerusalem, you know, and this idea of the Tower of Babel and things. So he'll just kind of throw out this little zinger of, oh, by the way, you know, we're the example of the Good Samaritan, without realizing that, like, well, that was what was so scandalous about the Good Samaritan, is that's the person that should not have stopped.
Right.
Or, you know, the one
that everyone assumed that was not going to do the right thing.
That's right.
You had a priest and you had a Levite.
Right.
And
the two that you would expect to have stopped.
Yes. They were the ones that had the law. They were, like we said, all throughout scripture, all throughout the Old Testament, there is always this command to care for the poor and the foreigner among you. And so these two people that should have known that and should have acted on it didn't. And the one person that people would assume, like, well, he's a pagan. Why would he care?
Right.
He's the one that stops and helps.
Right. Well, and to your point, that kind of shows you that you can have all of the knowledge of the law, you know, or all of the church things, and have the code of canon law completely memorized. But if you're passing that person by, you've missed the point of the gospel, and that's really the point. And I've always kind of wondered too, you know, if on that road everyone was kind of meeting up at the end of the day, like in Lord of the Rings, like at some, you know, tavern or something, right?
Yes.
You've got the Pharisee there, you've got the Levite there, and here walks in the Samaritan with the bound up person on the side of the road. Like, what would they have thought?
I know, would they have had their head and their face in their hands, like, oh crap, I hope that guy doesn't recognize me.
Well, but see, this is the point. The Samaritan wouldn't have had to say, excuse me, let me tell you what was right from wrong. Just seeing it.
Right.
Just seeing it, they would have known what happened and how they missed the mark. And that's what I think is really neat about this encyclical, is it's not like, okay, here's the rules. As a Catholic, this is how we need to treat AI. It's like, no, here's the gospel message. Here's what we should look like to the world in how we're operating. Look at the community that we're going to be building, the unity we're going to be building around this thing. And that's going to be the witness. The witness is not us saying what to do. The witness is the people of God doing the right thing. And the world looks at us and they say, oh, that's how Anthropic should be managing AI.
Yes.
Like the Catholics. Look at those guys. Right. That's the point. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also, as it says in the beginning, the church does not claim to assume the functions belonging to the state.
Right.
The church, you know, this, we know in history, the times when the church has become the state, there have been a lot of problems. And so I think that in the past 150 years since Rerum Novarum, the church has grown in this understanding of that, you know, we are here, like he says here, to walk alongside humanity. And not to, one, become the state and try to run everything, or to just sit here and impose on the state and everyone.
Well, and that's what was so beautiful about Rerum Novarum 150 years ago, because I don't remember if we kind of talked about the circumstances around Pope Leo XIII and when he wrote Rerum Novarum, but he was literally under house arrest. I mean, this
really, man, I didn't.
He could not leave the Vatican walls. He was He was completely under house arrest. He couldn't leave. You know, they were trying to decide at that point as a state. You know, Italy didn't even exist back then, right? It was just kind of these multiple states and things. And they had made him a prisoner of his own, you know, palace, basically. And so here's this, you know, little pope that can't even leave, that has no authority and power over the world at all civically. And he writes this encyclical about how we should look at the Industrial Revolution and how it's impacting the world. And everyone's like, who's this guy?
Yeah.
You know, and it's such an interesting thing, because it's from kind of the hiddenness and the smallness of that situation of we really had no power and authority over civic, you know, the society. It was really, hey, we're approaching this from the inside out and saying, guys, we're missing the mark here. And so just so for some frame of reference historically, I mean, of course, Pope Leo XIV is in a completely different situation. He's an American pope. You know, it's a kind of a world power thing, and he's certainly not held up in the Vatican. But still, it's that smallness. It's that, hey, remember, the church isn't here to impose anything. We're at this from a completely different angle.
Yeah. Well, and the popes, all the recent popes have traveled a lot, but in some way, they are still held up in the Vatican. The Pope runs the church.
Right.
But the Pope has no power, political power,
right,
military power, or anything outside the church. And yet, I would say that if you look at Pope Leo XIII writing Rerum Novarum, being, as you said, in house arrest in the Vatican, and that period lasted until World War II with Mussolini.
Yep.
But I would say the world probably looked at the church at the time of Pope Leo XIII and said, okay, now they don't have a state anymore. They don't have a military anymore, which it had before that. Right. So, okay, we now have control over it. And Pope Leo XIII writes an encyclical, and from that time, popes are become more vocal in the world, writing more. And I would say people then began to realize, well, wait a second, the Pope doesn't need a military or a state to have control over the world. There are now 1.5 billion Catholics in the world. The Pope has to say something to all the Catholics. Just that is going to have a huge impact. So I would say now people are, non-Catholics, are looking at what the Pope says because they know it's going to have a huge impact, if only through all the Catholics that are listening to him.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, here's the church. This is not a world power, right? They don't have a world economic power. You know,
They're in the UN, but they can't vote.
They're in the UN, but they can't vote. Right. So there's all these points of reference of the world, you know, and how it's tried to suppress the church. I mean, you think about the time of Constantine, and we've got this Holy Roman Empire, and basically Christianity is just taken over like wildfire, and just this constant persistence of the world to try to bottle this thing up and to try to stop it, you know, to try to stop the whatever the church is doing and the kingdom of God. And here's the church saying, well, you can, you know, you can lock us in the Vatican, but I'm still going to tell you that society always needs to be driven with our eyes on the gospel. And without doing that, then we're completely lost. And people were like, oh,
yep.
You know, we tried to bottle them up and we can't. It makes things worse. It's that whole mustard seed thing, right? You just, the more you bottle it up, the more it spreads. And so that is a beautiful way to look at it is like, well, who's the Pope, you know, and who's the church, and why are they imposing? Well, and Pope Leo says it, look, we're not imposing a thing. The church does recognize that we have an opportunity to help influence in the right way with this evangelical charity. Again, so it's not the here's what you need to do, but it's look at us as an example.
Yeah.
And here's how we can do life better with you, even if you're not Catholic. And we'll get to that in later chapters. But he's saying, even if you're not, you know, from other denominations, right? Or even from other world religions, look, we're walking through this together.
Yeah. And the church can say, you know, you do you. You know, you live life however you want. We're not here to make you do anything. But we're here to show you a life of peace, a life of purpose, and we're going to walk alongside you and invite you.
Oh, and that's it. Isn't it? I mean, just that beautiful image, because it's not, you know, it is this whole, hey, look, you do you. You guys keep fishing, you know, do whatever you do. But hey, but come follow.
Yeah.
And you can come and follow, and I'll show you a better way. And how the church has never lost that sense, even in 2,000 years, right? Yeah. It's really beautiful. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So continuing that thought then, I'm going to read paragraph 22. Starting from this twofold acknowledgement, the autonomy of earthly realities and the distinction between ecclesiastical and political spheres of competence allows for a clear understanding of the direction that the Second Vatican Council set for the Church in her relationship with the world. Gaudium et Spes reminds us that it is the task of the whole people of God, particularly its pastors and theologians, to listen to and distinguish the many voices of our times and to interpret them in the light of God's word, in order that the revealed truth may be more deeply penetrated, better understood, and more suitably presented. Yeah, the role of the church is to look at what's going on in the world and say, okay, well, how do we speak the gospel? How do we speak God's good news into this moment in time?
You know, this part, especially from Gaudium et Spes, this whole particularly of its pastors and theologians to listen to and distinguish the many voices of our times and to interpret them. It just reminds me again of that theme, Seth, that you and I were talking about a little bit earlier of this. You know, you walk into church, maybe you hear a homily and it has to do with, you know, the gospel. And maybe there's these things going on all around us, like AI, you know, taking over the world. And people are sitting in church thinking, what should we do? And you know, you maybe hear a pastor that's like, oh, we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about, you know, way more important things that aren't earthly. And here's Gaudium et Spes saying, no, it's the job of pastors and theologians to interpret what's going on in the world in light of God's word, not just, you know, not just to brush it under the rug. This is our opportunity to take all of these voices and to take what's happening in our times and really reveal truth for what it is. And so, I mean, just a really good reminder of what maybe the duty is of our pastors and theologians is again, not escapism, but addressing the thing.
Well, I want to continue on then. We have a short part from paragraph 23. I think that there's some stuff in even just this one sentence that I really want to dive in deep into. The church regards all who sincerely seek truth, goodness, and beauty as companions on the journey and considers them as precious allies in defending the dignity of every person and in caring for creation. So one of the things I want to look at here, and we're going to dive deeper into this in a following paragraph later on, not today, but and maybe next episode or the one after that. But the first part that says the church regards all who sincerely seek truth, goodness, and beauty as companions on the journey and considers them as precious allies. And there's a place later on where I think it was Pope Pope John the 23rd, he mentions, was the first pope to use the phrase in encyclical, all people of goodwill. And so this idea that we're the Christians and you're not. So we're the one that's here that has all the truth and you just have to listen to us. The church says anyone that seeks truth, goodness, and beauty as companions on the journey. And I know I've mentioned this before, but it's that the end of the last battle where you have this soldier who has come into Aslan's country and he says, but he's a soldier of the enemy. And he goes to Aslan, and he's like, well, wait a second, but I'm your enemy. Why am I here with you? And Aslan basically says, you can't do anything good in the name of my enemy, and you can't do anything evil in my name. So anyone that is seeking truth, goodness, and beauty,
right,
is, even if they don't know it, they're seeking God.
That's right. Well, this is another one of those references where if you'd not maybe read that before or had that context, especially from that's such a great one from C.S. Lewis, but this idea of truth, goodness, and beauty, what are those three things? They're all pathways to God. You know, so we're basically saying the church regards all who sincerely seek pathways to God, our companions on the journey, you know, and that's what's so important. It's like, well, you know, we all love beauty and our art and things. No, the Pope is saying These are all intrinsically these pathways to God. And if we look at society as, you know, someone is seeking truth, someone is seeking goodness or beauty, and maybe they have nothing to do with the Catholic Church, but that's a direct link and source pointing to God, then of course we would consider those people companions and we walk on the journey with them. Yeah. And this hey, let me check your card. Like, who are you? What's your identity? Are you Catholic? Yeah. You know, it's, no, we're getting close, right? Because we're all pursuing God.
Yeah. Well, and the church has taught us that it's not that we say God speaks the truth. God does things that is good and he makes things that are beautiful. God is truth.
Yep.
God is goodness and God is beauty.
Right.
So anything that embodies truth, goodness, and beauty is on its way to God.
That's right. Yeah. The rain falls on the just and the unjust, right? And that's the point, is everyone can experience this truth and goodness and beauty from God. And maybe they don't know it, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're all on that journey.
Right.
You know, even if you're Catholic and you go to Mass every week, you're still on that journey towards the true, the good, and the beautiful.
Right.
And it's important that we acknowledge that if you're listening to this and you sincerely are seeking those things, then you are, yes, you are companions with us. And that does not mean that we do not want to say, hey, you know, come join us in the Catholic Church, because, you know, we have access to so much goodness and beauty. You just think about all the beauty and in the Mass, the goodness, beauty, and truth in the Mass. Mm-hmm. We want you here with us. But that is, even if you're not there yet, doesn't mean we're going to say, oh, well, if you have no interest in becoming Catholic, then I don't want to work with you, you know?
Right. Right. I think he gets that a little bit too, if we end up getting to paragraph 25 at some point, but I do love this last line in this little paragraph, this in defending the dignity of every person and in caring for creation. And I was just kind of thinking about that. Can you defend the dignity of every person? Like, can those two things be separated? Can you sincerely defend the dignity of every person without caring for creation? Or can you maybe over care for creation and then you're not defending the dignity of people? You know, so there's this kind of there's a balance between the two. And I was kind of thinking about this just from our, you know, we talked about the progression of technology and how swiftly things go. And I just had this thought when I was reading this line of, remember back, I guess maybe 10, 20 years ago, cell phones, we were talking about it earlier, and just those pictures of like mounds of cell phones in garbage heaps, right? Of all this
landfills,
like, the landfills, this technology waste that was happening, you know, it was all in the service of, well, we're advancing technology and we're making the world better for people and look what we're doing for communications. And you'd see these like apocalyptic pictures of these like dead cell phones just everywhere. Yeah. And
And you think about technology for both the care of creation and the dignity of every person. Mm-hmm. I think about the video clips that I've seen of these landfills with all these electronics in it in other parts of the world. Like our electronics are shipped all over the world to get rid of them when they're past their life, and they end up in these landfills. And you see people picking through all these electronics so they can get all the precious metals and sell them and make some money.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's destroying the environment there, but it's also destroying their health.
Yeah.
You know, they're being exposed to all these heavy metals. And so our rush to get the next best toy, the next best technology, is having such a huge impact on both the environment and on so many people in the world.
That's right. Or even progressing AI, you know, and looking at these, you know, these massive server farms that are being built. And I think there's this sort of, well, we're advancing this technology because people want it. And we just, this is in the name of science, you know, we're just going to throw creation out the window right now. And we're just going to look at advancing this thing as quickly as possible. And I don't know why, but I did think of, have you ever seen Atari Game Over, that documentary?
Yes.
Okay. Where there's like 2,600 E.T. games, you know, that Atari made that were just a total flop, and they buried them in this landfill, and they had this whole documentary about it where this guy was digging this up because he didn't know if it was just an urban legend or true, and he ended up digging it up, and there they were, all the cartridges just sitting there in a landfill, you know. And it just reminds me of, you know, the progression of technology, whether it's for, you know, science and innovation or even for entertainment. And how it's such a connected to technology, the idea, the throwaway culture connected to technology. You said it the best. We're always after the next best toy, and just really sort of ruminating on that a bit. What does it mean to be part of a technology culture? Are we all in this consumerism culture, and is it a throwaway culture where we are just after the next best thing? I think Jeff Bezos talked about that once when he was coming out with the Kindle. Remember this? He said getting off of the technology treadmill. He wanted to build the Kindle in such a way where you didn't have to buy a new one every year. He wanted to make it where it was like the sustainable and lasting thing. And I loved that image of getting off of the technology treadmill. Of like, well, it's a new year. Let's get a new device. And what are we doing with our old one? Well, we're throwing it into a landfill.
Totally, For a number of years, I had the first generation Nook. And it finally died a couple of years ago, and I upgraded to a Kindle. But I do appreciate the ebook whole thing. It's so low powered.
Right.
You can't do anything on this. You can't watch a video. You can technically watch a video on the screen, but it, you know, it's like four or five frames per second. And so you just have to read a book.
Right.
And it's more technology than actually picking up a book, and I still enjoy picking up and reading books, but the fact that I can carry so many with me is great. But we're not trying to put every single bell and whistle into this.
Yeah.
We're just putting just enough to do what we wanted to do, which is read a book. And
that's right. You
know, this, I've had it for 2 years. I'm sure I will have this Kindle for at least another 15 years, if not more.
Because it's an appliance, and that's how it was considered when the Kindle came out. Is like, well, this is a reading appliance. You know, this isn't the iPhone. We're not trying to redo anything. You know, this is really just for the purpose of reading, and the e-ink technology behind it. Like you said, I mean, talk about a fun discussion. Just looking at the genius of e-ink. I mean, this is a technology that literally takes almost no power to produce. Yeah. I mean, we're steps away, Seth, if they concentrated more on e-ink, we are steps away from having moving pictures on our newspapers like Harry Potter. I mean, we need to continue to advance this technology to get to that point, because it would be so cool. But I mean, it's how low power it is, you know, how sustainable it is. So there are opportunities out there for really smart people to have this kind of look at things. And again, it's this defending the dignity of every person and caring for creation of, hey, we're not just trying to throw out, you know, the most amazing LLM that we can, you know, just no matter where we're putting the servers and no matter what kind of neighborhoods we're disrupting, but having smart people really say, okay, how do we make AI as efficient as e-ink or something like that, where it takes no power? And that's what I kind of appreciate about someone like, you know, a fellow nerd like Elon Musk, who's like, well, let's just put all the data centers in space. I mean, crazy, but I get it, right?
Crazy and wrong. But good thought.
But good thought. Well, at least thinking about it. What is the sustainability of the thing? Because if we don't think about those things and we're not caring about creation, then like you put perfectly in that example of these you know, third world countries that are going to landfills and pulling these batteries out and trying to sell them. I mean, there's no dignity in that. And I guarantee you, when you talk to someone who just bought an iPhone and you were to tell them stories, like, they don't even know that situations like that exist.
Yep.
So it's also this awareness of what is our role in defending the dignity of every person and caring for every person. And how do we do that? Maybe it is contributing to the next great technology that makes things more sustainable.
Yeah. Well, and I was just talking to my wife about this last week. There is a technology that it came out, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. This nonprofit created a light. It was a lamp. And it was just an LED light and it had a very simple set of gears, a little motor inside of it, and a chain and a weight. And what you do is you hang it up on the ceiling and you take the weight that's on the chain and you lift it up, and then you have it up high, and then it very slowly falls down, spins the motor, generates electricity, and turns on the light.
Friction, right? From the gravity.
Yeah. And it can run the light for, I think it's 2 hours.
Wow.
And then you just have to pick it back up again. And so they created this, and they have been giving it to people all around the world in these remote locations who have no access to electricity. So people that had no access to any form of light other than burning something after it got dark, they now have the opportunity to have a light so that they can work or read or spend time with their family after it gets dark. Hmm. And so there are a number of organizations that have been working on creating very easy and cheap and sustainable water purification systems.
Mm-hmm.
That we can use technology either to entertain ourselves, like we were saying with you know, the latest phone, the latest, you know, video game, or we can use technology to lift other people up. Or we can just focus on making what's cool for a year and then throwing it out and not thinking about the people that that's impacting.
Right. Well, and boy, that's really interesting, because I was just thinking when you were talking about all those examples of like kerosene lamps and things that people are using.
Yeah.
And then you're replacing all of that, and you don't have this need to sort of get the kerosene, get the oil, burn these things. And it's just this gravity light. But that's what I'm talking about. That type of innovation. I mean, how far away are we from a warp core, you know, that can just power everything, and it's this kind of the sustainable. That's what I always wondered when you're watching Star Trek. I mean, the amount of technology on those ships, right, and the amount of energy that they're using, and it's like, oh, it's just the warp core.
Yes,
you know, it's just so simple, right? And I'm sure at some point we'll get to that, but leading up to those things, just the amount of waste, right? Yeah. And is that an opportunity for us as humans to, okay, great, this is a technology that's advancing, but let's think about the sustainability of the thing. How can we make this thing as sustainable as possible, to where we're not having to power data centers and take up all of the electricity and water in neighborhoods to serve, you know, 1% of humanity when they're searching, you know, an LLM for, hey, write an email for me.
Or thinking about recycling the materials that come from all these electronics or anything else, to say, well, we don't do a lot of that because it's not cost effective.
Yeah.
But that's not the reason why you recycle. You don't recycle mainly. You shouldn't recycle mainly because it's cost effective. You should recycle because we don't want to keep throwing this stuff away. And as we said, harming other people and harming the environment, it's the right thing to do. And so either make it cost effective, or just say this is just a part of the cost of making the thing.
Right.
And putting it out there is the cost of eventually taking the material and reusing it in whatever comes afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. But a lot of kind of bringing us back to the very beginning of this conversation when we're talking bubbles. I mean, this is how bubbles are made, right? There's just this frantic race, you know, to get these products out there without any sort of thought or innovation or attention to detail that could be there. And then that's where you see bubbles pop, you know, and I think that's what kind of happened with the internet. And now we're getting to a point where it's been around for so long that the sustainability of the thing is pretty incredible. And, you know, we are seeing that on the AI side as well. I mean, you and I have discussed some of these models that Google especially are coming out with, where you're able to run these things on, you know, 16 gigs of RAM on a local computer. And it's like, wow, that's incredible. But that's, you know, that's true innovation. Now you're talking about true sustainability. If you can run, you know, even part of an LLM on a local machine, you know, with only 16, 32 gigs of RAM, that is an astronomical difference even than from we were a year ago with AI.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we just have a little bit more to cover in this episode, so let's just continue on so we're not here forever. But paragraph 25, understanding that the truth is a gift to be shared, not a possession to be monopolized, frees the church from the temptation of seeking forms of presence based on power. In order to rediscover the evangelical approach of a gentle proclamation of truth that is not imposed, St. John Paul II invited us to examine honestly the times when acquiescence was given to, quote, intolerance and even the use of violence in the service of truth, end quote. In the same vein, I too have reaffirmed that the church, quote, does not claim to possess a monopoly on truth, end quote, because truth is not a territory to be defended, but a good to be shared. There's a song that I love, Derek Webb, and he has a line in it. It says that the truth is, it doesn't say the truth is open source, but it's basically that the truth is free. And no one can have a monopoly on the truth. No one can say, and the way I read that, I think some people might read that and say, well, he's saying that the church does not have all the truth. And what he's saying is the church does not control all. If someone is out there and they have the truth, if someone is seeking the truth, they don't have to say, okay, well, let me go to the Pope and ask permission to use this.
Right. So we need to remember too that this encyclical was not written in English.
Right.
You know, we are looking at a translation. This is a quote from Pope Francis. I forget the encyclical's name. Evangelii Gaudium, I think is what it is. But he does talk about, you know, this whole thing about monopoly. I'll just read it really quickly because this is the quote that Pope Leo is referencing. Is, furthermore, neither the Pope nor the Church have a monopoly on the interpretation of social realities or the proposal of solutions to contemporary problems. And when you read it like that, it's like, well, of course. Like, again, we're saying that the Church isn't coming in saying we know better than everybody else and this is how society is supposed to run. Stay away from AI. Like, even Pope Francis is saying, look, the Pope nor the Church have this monopoly on interpretation. We're not looking at society and problems and we're saying we have all of the answers. This is something that we need, again, to walk with other people and to figure out what society is doing and help inform them based on the gospel. So I think it's interesting that he mentions this whole, you know, the church does not possess a monopoly on truth. I think what he's tying in there is truth is sort of this idea of interpreting social reality, you know, understanding and providing proposals to problems. You know, what is the reality? I think more that word truth is really more meaning we don't have a monopoly on interpreting reality.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what you think about that. But I remember reading and I was thinking, well, because that's where I think a lot of people can get hung up. And this might be such a perfect soundbite off of this encyclical of, oh, the Pope said we don't have the truth. And I don't think it's saying that. It's more saying we don't have the monopoly on the reality. I don't know what you think about that stuff, but just sort of a quick interpretation there.
Yeah. And I would say, but even with just the idea of religious truth.
Sure.
There's a great section in the Catechism that looks at, it's like, well, yes, the church teaches that it has the fullness of truth. But that is not saying that anyone that is not Catholic has no truth.
Right.
And it goes through, it's like, well, we have all of our, you know, we have the Orthodox Church, which has apostolic succession, which has the sacraments. And they're very close. They, as you know, a number of popes have said, they are the other lung, mm-hmm. you know, in the East. And then you have all of our separated brethren, all of our Protestant brothers and sisters that see Christ the same way we do, that look at the look to the Trinity, that look to God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And then you have all the monotheistic religion. Well, then you have the Jews, who are our brothers and sisters, who, you know, where we came from. And then you have all the other monotheistic religions. And then you have everyone that's seeking some sort of divinity. That you have all, there's a lot of truth out there that people seek and that people understand and know.
Right.
So I think that, so when I read Monopoly on the Truth, it's not a yes or no.
Right.
You either have all the truth or you have none of the truth.
That's right. Because the next line, because truth is not a territory to be defended.
Yes.
But it's a good to be shared. And we talked about it just about a paragraph up where, you know, we're collaborating with all of those that are seeking truth, goodness, and beauty, because we know that truth, goodness, and beauty are all pathways to God. So it's this idea of, we don't have a monopoly on God. You know, we don't have a monopoly on the truth and goodness of beauty and these pathways to God. He shares that freely with the world. And that's a great point. I think there's maybe two ways to look at this. There's the religious sense of truth, goodness, and beauty, all these pathways to God, and we're walking with those people and we would consider them allies. Yes. But then there's also this reaffirming that when it comes to society and the realities of solving problems within society, it's not the church that does this alone.
Yes.
You know, we're sharing the gospel and we're helping inform people. But, you know, wouldn't that be nice, Seth? We just go to one place. We just like you said, call the Vatican or the Pope. Hey, how am I supposed to do this? Oh, well, this is exactly how you're supposed to do it.
Yeah.
That's not even the gospel message. It's more walking and journeying with these people.
Right. And life is messy.
And life is messy. Right.
Yeah. And we both have an experience. We both experienced coming into the Catholic Church as adults. And, you know, I know we've both had this experience, and I've heard so many people, you know, I direct the Journey Home program. And so every month I'm hearing four stories of people that have come into the Catholic Church as adults. And every single one of them will say, I was seeking truth before I discovered the Catholic Church. And whatever truth, goodness, and beauty I had, I brought in with me. I did not leave any of that behind because it was the wrong truth. Anything that was good, true, and beautiful in my life before I became Catholic, I was encouraged to bring it into the church with me.
Right.
And I would say that for anyone. And one of the things that I really hope for especially for this series, but for all the stuff that we're doing, all these episodes that we're doing with That Nerdy Catholic, is my hope is that someone will be listening to these episodes and say, well, you know, I've never even considered the Catholic Church, because I've always seen the Catholic Church as this monolithic, imposing morality from the outside. And I have what I see as true and good and beautiful. And from what I've seen, has nothing to do with the Catholic Church. But to say, you know, I want you to look at the Catholic Church from the good in it, and to see, like as Pope Leo was saying here, the church is here to walk alongside everyone and to, you know, to be Christ to everyone, which is, you know, Christ laid down his life for everyone, and that's what we're called to do. And we're not here to impose, but we're here to walk alongside you.
Right. And, you know, I think Pope Francis said it best a while back that, you know, any social endeavor that you're looking at in order to make change or make the world a better place. And we're talking about AI here in this encyclical and what it means to do this the right way and more responsibly. You can never separate a social endeavor from a personal relationship with Jesus Christ.
Yep.
And that's really the bottom line. And that's I think what, and we'll get to it way later in you know, chapter one of this encyclical and things like that. But Pope Leo is affirming that whenever you're using the gospel as sort of the base for, you know, these social constructs and what we need to do in society, you're really just pointing, you're helping the world also point back to God. You know, well, why would we think that or do that in the first place? Well, let me tell you about Jesus, right? I mean, that's the point. I mean, it's this, you know, yes, we walk and we journey with you, but we're also walking and journeying with you so that we can show you, you know, this treasure, you know, and show you Jesus. And so you can't, you can't separate the two, but it is really it's a start, right? And these are opportunities, yes, where these people have this, yeah, truth, and they're on their way. And like you're saying, yep, you know, you're journeying with these people that are on their way, instead of saying, oh, you're totally missing the mark. Here's all the things you have to do to be correct. Right. It's like, yeah, you know, you're on the way, and let me show you Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. And thinking about, well, what does it mean to be a Christian? Well, and what does it mean to be, you know, I've had this conversation with a lot of people, both before and after I became Catholic. What does it mean to be a missionary?
Yeah.
Well, a missionary, that it's we're all called to be missionaries as Christians. We're all called to be, right, missionaries where we are. And that is just to walk alongside people and yeah, be the light, so that people see your good works and give glory to God in heaven. Not, yeah, to say, oh, what a great Christian you are, but no, this is what God wants for all of us.
Yeah.
So I want to wrap up. Yeah. I'm going to read one more paragraph, and then this we can have the wrap-up comments for this episode. So paragraph 27, in light of what has been said so far, the church's social doctrine can be seen more authentically. It is not a handbook of principles and norms to be applied, but a process of sharing discernment. It is born from the encounter between the eternal truth of the gospel and the questions of history. It allows itself to be challenged by the signs of the times and draws nourishment from the contributions of science, culture, and human experience. Therefore, when the dignity of our brothers and sisters is violated, when politics fails to address the tragedies of humanity, when the economy turns against the person, or science oversteps the limits of competence, the church, together with other Christian denominations and believers of other religions, must make her voice heard, not in order to dominate, but to promote communion. Understood in this way, social doctrine becomes a theology of communion in history, a history in which the Word made flesh continues to be present through dialogue, memory, and prophecy. Mm. I mean, that's basically saying, in a better way, what we've just been trying to say.
Yeah. This is beautiful. I love that line. This is all, everything he's talking about is born from an encounter between the eternal truth of the gospel and the questions of history.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and he constantly goes back to these themes of, yes, we're walking together with other Christian denominations and maybe even other believers from other religions, and we're walking in communion with these people. I mean, that's the definition, yeah, of social doctrine. But it's because we're in a history in which the Word made flesh continues to be present through, yes, dialogue. I mean, we're, yes, here as representatives of Jesus, and we're dialoguing with these people, you know, and we're able to show them the way. We're able to bind people's wounds. We're able to find the ones that are on the side of the road that no one else is looking at. We're the personification, yeah, and the living, breathing body of Christ. And that's what Pope Leo, yeah, I think, is saying here, is you can't separate the two. You know, you can't have, yeah, you can't have the eternal truth of the gospel and our history be separated. You know, the Christ is still moving through the earth, and that's where you're seeing these beautiful encounters with other people, other religions, others that are walking with us that have the same goals in mind.
Yeah. And how many times do we live as if we were deists, saying, right, that, well, God just started everything, God gave us morality, God gave us all these rules, but he just set it in motion and we have to do everything, and he's just staying up there watching us.
Mm, right.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, the gospel is that God is, through Jesus, is at work in human history.
Right.
And he still is.
Right. Yep. Even when we're talking about artificial intelligence, and you, yes, think, oh, that's the furthest thing from the gospel in the Bible. Well, no, yeah, because, yeah, this is our day and age, and this is our history. And that's what Pope Leo said, yeah, at the very beginning of this encyclical. We all have our challenges, every generation. And, yeah, and how do we look at the gospel in this challenge today?
Yeah, and I love this sentence in here. It allows itself to be challenged by the signs of the times,
right,
and draws nourishment from the contributions of science, culture, and human experience.
Yeah.
When we did the series on the history of math and the history of science. That was people in the church wanting to understand the world better. We're Christians, so we're just going to focus on the religious truth. It's like, no. That's why the tagline for That Nerdy Catholic is all truth is God's truth.
Yep.
There is no scientific truth and then religious truth. And, anything, like we were saying before, anyone who is seeking the true, good, and beautiful. So the true, anything that is true is God's truth, because God created everything and God is continually at work in everything.
Well, and it's through this exploration and innovation and invention and things, we're a living, breathing religion. We're not, Catholicism, and a little bit different from how you and I grew up, but we're not a religion of the word as in a dead, written word. We're a religion of the living, breathing word, capital W, that still lives and moves in our lives today, and is exposing us to these new things. And that's what's so exciting about, being a part of technology and science and everything else, is because you're looking at those things from a completely different lens of exploration, because you're continuing to draw closer to God, and his and his creation. And I look at that as kind of tech nerds, and we're thinking like, oh, this is drawing us closer to God. I know there's a lot of people out there that are like, oh, technology is kind of the anti-God, but we're saying, no, it's this is God giving us these abilities to find out more about him, and just the creative playfulness of everything on earth and in the heavens that we're able to explore is a really beautiful thing as a Christian to be able to have freedom to do. And it all kind of ties back to this encounter with the gospel.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that we can use technology to lift up everyone.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and not just that we can use technology to lift up everyone, but the development of technology has made it so much easier to lift up everyone.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
These aren't enemies of our gospel work. These are things that can help, facilitate the gospel work even more in society. And maybe we'll talk about that in later podcasts. Maybe that's the, that's something that we can look at AI as a tool for, progressing the gospel, instead of something to sort of be afraid of. So that'll be an interesting take.
Well, yeah. And you look at just one example, you were mentioning this before, Lee, atomic energy. Mm-hmm. You can when we discovered the power within the atoms, the amount of energy that can be released, you can either blow up the world or you can create so much clean energy from it. And it's all how you use it. And so you can use technology to oppress people. You can use technology to become the most comfortable, rich person, not caring about anyone else, or you can use technology to serve others and to lift others up.
Wow, that is a great parallel that you just came up with too, Seth. I'm reminded of, back in World War II, I worked in a building that was part of the Manhattan Project in Manhattan, so the building is still there, it's a federal building, but that's why they called it the Manhattan Project. And that's where they did a lot of their testing and things like that. Yeah. And of course, back then they thought, look, if we do this, there might be a chain reaction and we destroy the entire world.
Yes.
I mean, and this thing just takes over and we're toast. Right. Don't you see that sort of, sensationalism happening with AI right now?
Yeah.
People are like, look, if we create this thing, we are toast. Like, this thing's just going to take over. And it's almost this really interesting parallel with atomic energy, because it's very powerful. But there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of fear around what's this going to do? Are the molecules going to just be staying floating in the air? There were just so many questions around it. Right. Yeah. And yeah, that's an interesting parallel. I like that. That might be a journey we need to take even further. But it's this idea of, what did it take to get past those things? Really smart people and testing and sort of knowing the limits and knowing let's not do that, because we might blow up the world. Let's do something else, right? So it took people saying, well, maybe we do. Let's pump the brakes. You know, let's make sure that we're doing this the right way. And that's a really interesting parallel. I like that. Yeah,
not to just get rid of it completely and say, let's not even go down this road.
Right.
But let's do it carefully and thoughtfully. And yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that can, that should be how we approach any technology.
Yeah.
Not that it's something to be feared and avoided at all cost, and not something that, well, this is a good in and of itself, so therefore we need to throw everything at it.
Right.
But we need to approach it with wisdom and prudence, all the virtues.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And so we are definitely going to be going deeper into those themes as we go along in this encyclical, but we are running long at this point. So I think it is time to wrap up for today. So Lee, thank you for all the insights.
Absolutely. My pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And thank you for joining us. I want to remind you, if you go over to thatnerdycatholic.com, you can sign up for email list, get updates on when we put out new episodes. If you go to thatnerdycatholic.com/merch, you can get Nerdy Catholic swag, t-shirts, mugs, and prints to show the world that you can be a nerd and a Catholic at the same time. And you can go to thatnerdycatholic.com/support to help support us financially. Our expenses here at That Nerdy Catholic have gone up recently, and any financial support you can give us would be greatly appreciated. You can send a one-off tip or join as a monthly supporter. So thank you, Lee, again for joining me today, and thank you all for listening. See you next time. God bless.
God bless.
System shut down.